Each week, we are unlocking the physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual tools that help athletes reach their biggest goals in sports. Well, Pursuit Peeps, I'm a little sad to announce that this is our final episode of 2023. But don't worry, we will be back on January 11th with an exciting lineup to kick off 2024. If you need some inspiration or some good listens while you're traveling or you've got some downtime this holiday season, just scroll on back and check out some of our fan favorite recent episodes like episode 76 with sports psychiatrist Dr. T. We totally dig into developing a competitive mindset and it is so good. You've got to check that one out. Episode 83 with swimming Olympic medalist Elizabeth Beisel. We talk about growing into a leader. She has a very powerful story. There is a reason that the swimming community absolutely loves her. You're going to fall in love with her too. So go check out episode 83 with Elizabeth. And then there's episode 89, where the amazing three-time world champ and Olympic silver medalist softball player Haley McClinney is dropping truth bombs, like dropping mics and truth bombs all over the episode. She talks about falling in love with failing. And what? Like, what is that? That is actually really important. I know as athletes who want to win, we don't like to talk about failure, but there is a reason that Haley McClinney is a professional softball player, a three-time world champion, an Olympic medalist. Like, she understands why failing is so important. So go check out episode 89. Then episode 91, Think Big, Act Small with two-time Olympic medalist skier Shannon Barkey. Shannon is the best storyteller, you guys, and she takes us through her journey, how she won two Olympic medals, and how thinking big but acting small got her there. And then one of our most recent episodes with David Colturi, episode 95, he is a professional high diver, and so many people have told me that his episode has just impacted them in amazing ways at the just the right time and the right way. And he talks about how courage is a learned skill. So go check out those episodes. We're also going to make sure to link those in the show notes so you can just check them out easily after this is done. You don't have to remember all of it. But feel free to scroll back through all the old episodes. There is so much just gold waiting for you to find in those episodes. But back to today's episode. Now, I have been looking forward to this conversation for quite some time. There is a hot topic in sports that I've been struggling to keep up with and understand, as it's just a complete 180 from when I was in college. And that's the conversation around name, image, likeness, also known as NIL. And whether you know a little bit or a whole lot about this topic, Dr. Matt Bowers gives us some fascinating insights into the wild west of NIL in this episode. Matt's an associate professor of instruction and the director of the sport management program at the University of Texas at Austin, hook 'em. He studies the role of sport in generating positive experiences and outcomes with a particular emphasis on youth development in and through sports. His work has been featured in Sports Illustrated, Wired, The Atlantic, Wall Street Journal, South by Southwest, and the Aspen Institute for Sports for All, Play for Life. Matt has served also as an advisor to South by Southwest, Nike's Project Move, several of Aspen Institute's projects, and recently he concluded his appointed term on the Science Board for the President's Council on Sports, Fitness, and Nutrition. So it's safe to say that Matt's a pretty knowledgeable guy, and he always has the pulse on the ever-changing landscape of sports. With a new year coming up, this is a great time to start evaluating your skill set and figuring out how you can grow and become an even better athlete in 2024. If you've been wanting to start harnessing your mental game, but you're just not really sure where to start, I have the perfect gift for you. I created a free guide with the top 10 mental skills that every athlete must have. And it's not just a list of the skills, but it's also a guide and a self-assessment to help you kickstart your journey to confidence. Go grab your copy over at laurawilkinson.com/skills. That's laurawilkinson.com/skills. All right, before we get started, make sure you smash that subscribe button and give Pursuit of Gold a 5-star review. If you love this podcast, please share your favorite episodes with your friends. As much as we are trying to help you grow, we need you to help us grow. And that allows us to continue to bring you resources, tools, and inspiration to help you level up in 2024. All right, I believe that there's gold in your future, so let's dive on into this episode. Dr. Matt Bowers, welcome to the Pursuit of Gold podcast. I am so excited to pick your amazing brain today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here. When I look at your, you know, your list of previous guests, I feel like the best way to describe me to your audience is non-Olympian half hours. So
okay, that doesn't make you any less impressive, because what you do impacts so many athletes and people coming up through sports. So we really want your brain on things. Well, give us a little bit of your background. Do you have any like athletic background, or have you just always loved sports? Like, how did you get to be the director of sports management program at UT, the amazing UT? I love that you're a Longhorn, by the way.
Yes, Hook'em Horns, of course, which I'm legally obligated to say.
Of course.
Yeah, so I've always loved sports ever since I was a little dorky, you know, second grader carrying around a sports section, you know, newspaper under my arm and talking about trades and things like that.
Did you really?
I did. Yes, I did. I used to write letters to my, I'm from the Tampa Bay area in Florida, and I used to write letters to the general manager of the Buccaneers to tell him my ideas.
And, oh my gosh.
I'm not sure if those letters, my dad claims he sent those letters. I'm not sure.
I was wondering if you ever got a reply. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't recall a reply. But so I've always been fascinated by sports. Was a big basketball player growing up, but played a lot of different sports and played basketball in high school. And, you know, I knew I wanted to go into studying sports, working with athletes, thinking about teams. And so I, you know, was thinking about where I would go to college and all that stuff. And I ended up staying home and going to the University of Florida so that I could study sport management, which is what I'm still in. So I did my undergraduate, my master's, and my PhD all in the field of sport management, which is, for those who don't know, I would describe as a broad field. You know, everything that sort of the business and culture of sports touches are things that we think about and our students, you know, learn about. So while I was at the University of Florida, I had the good fortune of working with the football program for a number of years and transitioning over to work with the women's basketball program in particular as a grad assistant. Thought that I may pivot a little and kind of just go into the coaching world, and then kind of realized that I don't know if I had what it needed, you know, to be a great coach. I loved the intellectual side of it. I loved the interpersonal side of it, but the time demands and the, you know, as you know, being in the world that you're in, it's a full on commitment. And so I ended up pivoting again and deciding to do my PhD here at the University of Texas. And my focus was on athlete development. So how do we develop better athletes and better people through sports? How do we make sports work better? And so I feel like I have one of the best jobs in America. You know, I get to talk about sports and I get to work with an incredibly diverse and bright and energetic group of students who all want to work in the sports industry in some way. Some want to go to work in professional sports. Some want to, you know, work in collegiate sports. Some at, you know, community, grassroots sports, some at the national and international level. So yeah, I feel really fortunate that I get to continue to think about these fascinating issues that are arising, these fascinating challenges with, like, how do we make sports work better for people, right? And how do we navigate the rapidly changing landscape of sports, like we're going to talk about today with NIL. Like, there's so much. It's like drinking out of a fire hose these days. There's so much change so rapidly, and that can be really exciting, but it can be really, you know, if you're in it, it can be really stressful
and overwhelming. Yeah, for sure. And I love that your passion really is to develop the athletes, to help them develop as people. And that's when I coach mindset and performance now, and I love one-on-one interactions and really just feeling like I can pour into a person, because, you know, what you learn in sports is amazing and it can make you an amazing athlete, but really it's changing you as a person and making you this more incredible person that lasts way beyond sports, right? We can all have this passion for sports, but it's amazing when we let sports develop us as incredible people. I think that's so cool. And I love that. I know you didn't start at Texas, but I love that you got here as fast as you could.
That's right.
I'm a Texan through
staying.
And through. Yeah, there you go. See, smart move. Well, Matt, let's dig into it. So one of the reasons I asked you to come on was because of this whole NIL thing. Like, I am going to date myself, and I always do on the show. I'm like older than dirt. My kids think it's crazy that I'm older than Google. They're like, oh my goodness, that's ancient, right?
Older than Google. Yeah.
Yes, I'm like ancient. Yeah. Back in my day, I'm going to say it, like, it was illegal to take any money. Like, I couldn't take any kind of stipend, any kind of prize money, any kind of anything. Like, we weren't allowed to do that. And I saw coaches get fired when they would try to give perks to athletes or things like that, you know, and now I'm seeing NIL and I'm like, wait, isn't that what we weren't allowed to do? And isn't that what people were getting fired over? So can you just kind of start us off with the basics? Like, let's just get a good foundation so we all have an understanding of what exactly is this whole name, image, likeness thing? What does that mean?
Yeah. So what we're doing is we're bringing the payments above the table in a right. way, right? So yeah. So for those who are not acquainted with it, this NIL name, image, and likeness stuff, you know, has been simmering for a long time, has been kind of bubbling up as a result of some lawsuits, as a result of some kind of just changes in the broader landscape and marketplace. But what it basically is kind of what you already described, where you are now allowed to use yourself, your name, your image, a likeness of yourself, to be able to receive benefit, financial benefit. And so that's the simplest way to think about it. You can now market yourself and officially be able, depending on which state you're in and some of the legalities of that, officially be able to benefit financially from that. And so this all kind of technically originated about 2.5 years ago, the summer of 2021. And, you know, we've seen just, it's like the Wild West. Currently, there are no federal guardrails or guidelines. And that's something that's actually sort of a major priority for the new NCAA president, Charlie Baker, you know, come in and try to be able to broker some sort of national level guardrails, guidelines, because almost everyone's asking for them,
right.
You know, depending on whatever stakeholder group, whether it's coaches, whether it's athletic departments, whether it is student athletes, everybody's sort of seeking a little bit more guidance. And I think what's been interesting with this is what Florida was the first to jump on this, and then kind of instantly California, Texas, other big
domino
states
effect.
that are recruiting hotbeds were like, well, hold on a second. Like, we can't be losing, you know, football players in particular across the board, of course, but we can't be losing these 5-star recruits to Florida or Florida State when they should be staying here in Texas, but we don't have NIL, you know? And so a lot of what we have in this moment has evolved from that impulse of like, well, I don't want to lose out on anything, so let's slap something together and put it in place, and then let's, you know, see how the dust settles.
Right. Not worry about the ramifications till they hit, right?
Right.
So how is NIL different from just a direct sponsorship?
Well, in some ways it's not necessarily, you know, and so I guess maybe it's easy to think about this in terms of some models, you know, like some folks that are out there doing this. So one of the, you know, perhaps the early model for a student athlete who is fully taking advantage of what NIL enables would be Olivia Dunn, the gymnast for LSU. She was sort of the first, like, whoa, this person is cranking in, you know, some money here. And what she did was she leveraged her already really large social media following to then be able to approach or be approached by brands to work on sponsorship, representation types of apparel deals, things like that. And so in most cases, what we're seeing is an athlete leveraging their NIL, but particularly the NIL that they've cultivated through their social media accounts.
Gotcha.
And taking that as their sort of currency to kind of go out and work with big brands and things. And like anything in college athletics in the United States, there's definitely the haves and the have-nots,
right?
You know, as we've seen this shake out. So what we're seeing with NIL is not impacting all sports and all student athlete populations in the same way. You know, it's when we look at the data around this, as you would expect, it's been predominantly football and men's and women's basketball. Women's basketball has been interesting. Some of the highest NIL earners in the country are in women's basketball. You have Angel Reese and Flauje Johnson from LSU. You have Caitlin Clark from Iowa. You have Paige Buchers from UConn. And, you know, I think what's really interesting about that is, you know, and we can get into this a little bit more, but, you know, as we look at issues of equity and access for women's sports, and which are historically under-resourced and not necessarily made to be as much of a focal point as potentially they should, although that's shifting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, brands are seeing like, well, we can reach a very attractive demographic through some of these women's basketball athletes or this gymnast. In some ways, it's been an interesting moment of kind of leveling at the top some of the big earners and the big performers in a way that we haven't historically seen in sort of the previous system.
Right. Yeah, it is interesting that way. I mean, are athletes using, like, still using agents and things to like help them broker these NIL deals, or do they have to do that on their own?
Some of them are using sort of, you know, their sort of management group, their business management groups. A lot of them are leaning on the school to a certain extent. I have to be careful kind of how I talk about that.
Sure.
And I'm not insinuating anything.
Right.
But like they're leveraging the infrastructure and the resources now that the schools are providing. So for example, your university may be a direct partner with one of the big NIL marketplaces like Open Doors.
Is that what a collective is? Because I keep seeing that word in all these NIL articles.
Collectives are huge right now. And no, it's not.
Okay, never mind. So, we'll get to that later. Okay.
Yes and no. Sorry. So
you're supposed to explain this, Matt, not make me more confused.
I know. Well, everybody's confused. That's the thing. Like, and you can talk with senior athletics officials. You can talk with student athletes.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody quite knows exactly what's okay, exactly what's not okay. It's a really strange moment in time, and it's one that I'm here for, mm-hmm. you know, in a way, because
well, it's exciting, right?
It's exciting. I tend, as someone who studies this stuff at a sort of macro level, I love a little chaos, right? Like we've long had a system that obviously didn't allow student athletes like yourself,
right,
you know, to be able to, you know, pursue the types of opportunities that are naturally open to them in a way that a computer science student could, you know? And so I tend to be somebody who loves to see the pendulum swing a little bit. And, mm-hmm. But the fascinating thing is that the pendulum has swung so far that it's kind of unnerving, I think, to people. So yeah, you know, if it sounds confusing as I explain it, and I will do my absolute best, but if it sounds confusing, it is confusing.
Okay. So I'm not just the only one lost. That makes me feel
no,
a little bit better.
You are not. And the number of even student athletes that maybe I have in class or that I connect with on campus will come into my office and say like, so what am I supposed to do for this? You know, like they're feeling this sort of pressure,
right?
Because everyone's talking about it, but they may be a diver, right? Or they may be somebody who doesn't have the same level of infrastructure built around promoting them and, you know, pursuing these types of things. And so you end up with a sort of like, yeah, so what are we supposed to do here? So yeah, it's everybody right now. So, okay, let me clarify a couple of terms.
Okay.
You heard me say marketplace. And so marketplaces are exactly what they sound like they are, right? So Open Doors is the largest one of these. So I'll kind of use that as an example. There are others like Mogul, you know, there's a handful of competitors in the space, but what these are like third party brokers, you know, so they create a system where you as an athlete can have a profile and businesses can go in and they can seek you out for their specific needs. Or vice versa, right? Like a business could post an opportunity and then you as an athlete who's a member of that can go in and look for kind of a match there, right? So that is something that a lot of schools are now providing, that level of partnership with these marketplaces. A lot of universities are now providing that partnership as a starting point, in addition to some of the other things they do. But you know, you could go to a Texas and know that you through Open Doors can be pursuing things in a way that is, and these companies, you know, claim to and I think largely do to the extent that they can, like manage the legalities and the regulations around it, making sure that they're not putting you into a position that's going to jeopardize eligibility or anything like that. So that's what a marketplace is, and these exist on the web, right? And you're listeners can, you know, they can Google this right now. You can go to Open Doors and click around and see what I'm talking about. But you threw out the big word that is really confusing and stressful, which is collectives.
Yeah.
So collectives are booster run and booster kind of funded entities that enable sort of a coordination of efforts, right? So they fundraise and then they get money, and then working a collective can work with the university athletic department to sort of resource things and funnel things in a way that makes the most sense. So for example, very early on here at Texas, one of the first collectives that popped up was called the Clark Field Collective. And one of their fundraising initiatives was that they wanted to give every offensive lineman at Texas who commits to Texas a lump sum, basically like a salary that is relatively obscene, right? Like in the grand scheme, like maybe around what I make or a little, you know.
Yeah.
Not that that's a good benchmark for anything. But yeah, so that is, you know, as you watch now with the Longhorns, our Longhorns, you know, are having a pretty good football season. And a lot of that has come from a very solid offensive line and the stability that comes from that. And that's not really, you know, an accident, right? So, and it's legal. It's not,
right.
Nothing untoward has been done. But one of the early challenges that we've seen is you had all these kind of donor-driven collectives pop up. And at Texas, I think we had five pop up within the sort of first year. And one of the things that we noticed was that was making that coordination of efforts actually more difficult, and that the way we think about allocating resources. So Texas was the first, I believe, athletic department to create what's called the Texas One Fund, which is like an umbrella collective that kind of manages these things. But if you're getting in the weeds and your head is spinning about what I'm talking about, I think just basically come back to this idea that these are now permissible booster-driven groups that can raise money and direct those funds to the athletic department and to athletes in a way that was always I think I made this reference right as we were starting, was always kind of under the table at certain places, and now is simply a reality that is permitted. And I know there's a lot of angst around collectives, and I think for reasons you can probably infer naturally.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's the basics of what it is. It's taken what was, you know, the bagmen, you know, that were always kind of how we think about some programs and things, and brought that to something that is now allowed.
Right. So yeah, I'm just gonna get into it then. Like, is the school starting to benefit, other than just the athletes doing well? Is the school directly benefiting from those things as well?
I would say maybe indirectly benefiting. You know, that now there can be some fundraising. There's already fundraising, a great deal of fundraising.
Right.
You know, you probably get hit up all the time. So there's a great deal of fundraising around capital projects, you know, new buildings and new arenas and all that kind of stuff. And you know, new facilities for certain sports and whatnot. Those already exist. And so I think, you know, when we look at the benefits of what are accruing from the collectives, they are probably a little more indirect to everybody else, you know, who isn't a current student athlete.
Mm-hmm. Are there situations where, you know, if the school, whether it's, you know, and I may confuse it all again here, but whether it's their collective or they're offering, you know, assistance with marketplaces and things like that to help the athletes. But I guess, can the school like persuade an athlete to be taking certain deals because maybe they know this company has helped them out? Or, you know, are the athletes at all being pressured to take certain deals because the school's like offering that, or because, you know, like I'm looking at like Utah, they had, you know, 85, was it the Utah Utes football team?
Yeah.
Gave like 85 trucks, you know, to their football players, but then they're also responsible for the tax payments on those cars. The players are. And so like, what are you pressured into taking these things because you're on a team sometimes, even if it has ramifications, like now I have to pay the taxes for this? Like, what is there any backlash like that so far, or not really?
Not real. I absolutely get the point that you're making and the concern that you have over it. And my sense is the pressure, not to overuse the term, but is maybe a little bit more like indirect, right? And so in that Utah deal, I would be shocked. I remember the deal that you're talking about. I know exactly what you're referencing. I don't recall exactly, you know, I haven't like followed up on that at all from its original announcement. I would be shocked if the collective that supported that allowed the athletes to be disadvantaged from a tax standpoint. Mm-hmm. You know, I would be shocked that there wasn't some way of covering that, because, you know, they want it as a recruiting advantage, right? So it's something, it behooves them to do it in a way that, you know, doesn't come with a lot of, you know, a lot of negative things that might arise from.
Right. You'd think so.
you would think so. And you would hope so.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the, maybe a slightly different challenge, you know, as an example is, so Texas is a Nike school, right? So what if Lululemon comes to, you know, one of our swimmers and divers, mm-hmm. right? Or the whole team, and says like, hey, we want to have you represent Lululemon, mm-hmm. right? Like, we want you to wear our apparel. We want you to, you know, if you're having an interview after the meet, or, you know, as you're making your way in and out, we want you to wear like Lulu stuff.
Right.
How do we handle that? Right. And that's one of the challenges I know for athletic is like individual deals that might actually conflict with existing program level deals.
Right.
And I think these are being handled on a case by case basis, but that's a new challenge, right? If you're a Nike school and one of your top women's basketball players is now sponsored by Adidas, do right. you allow that? Does that jeopardize your relationship with Nike? Does that, you know, like how do you manage that? And these are things that are being managed on the fly mm-hmm. at this point, in part because, as I referenced earlier, there's no national level guidelines for how this should operate. Like, that's exactly the type of situation that a national level guideline could
help with. Yeah.
Help with. Now, as I say that, maybe let me digress for a second about sport policy in the United States. So in general, we the people of the United States, we do not prefer to pursue policy solutions at the national level unless we absolutely have to. We've tended historically to have these governance structures that really want to prioritize state level autonomy, mm-hmm. right? So like Texas can make its rules, California can make its rules, and, mm-hmm. and we like it that way. However, in a situation like this, I think this is one of those moments where we might see just enough of a necessity to level the playing field.
Right. Like I get that too, because you do need some overall guidelines with maybe the states allowed to make more specific calls on things. We had this issue at the Olympics. So, you know, when I go to the Olympics, the USOPC, like our countries, they're sponsored by somebody. And then our national governing body, which would be like my sport, like diving, USA Diving or something, they have their sponsor, you know, apparel sponsor. And then personally, I may have a different sponsor. Like, I had that situation going into the 2000 Olympics. There was a USOPC sponsor, there was a US Diving sponsor, and then I had a different personal sponsor. And so I had to know, like, I have to wear my USOPC outfitting on the award stand. In the march out, I had to wear my USA Diving things, you know, but in the competition, I could wear my personal gear. And so we had some defining lines. Granted, we were still figuring out how to and how not to break rules, you know, safely and wisely for all parties. But it is a juggle. And, you know, you kind of expect that more at that like higher level. But like, I'm thinking college is kids coming out of high school, like it's still all fairly brand new. And to get thrown into that is a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They're kind of working through some of those similar things. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, it's like, I don't think many people, whatever your political affiliation, have a lot of faith in Congress to be able to develop something that is really like thoughtful, you know, and really captures the nuances. So
no.
I think there's some fear in that if you're an athletics administrator or a coach or whatever. But yeah, this new landscape is something that is brought with it a lot of opportunity, but a lot of stress as well. And I know it's something that, you know, it's in my background where I really try to understand, especially at the national level, looking at how do we design better systems to do more good, you know, and to make sports, as you really nicely described at the beginning of the conversation, to not just produce good athletes, right? But good people through sports, and to recognize that those are not mutually exclusive propositions, mm-hmm. right? So as I look at it from my zoomed out view in the work that I do, I think one of the things that worries me is the fact that we already ask so much of young athletes these days. Yeah. I mean, we've jumped the shark in terms of what we require of an athlete to even be able to put themselves in a position to get to a school like Texas, for example. Now we're layering on top of that. And some states allow NIL at the high school level. Texas is not one of them.
Oh, currently. Really? I didn't even know that.
Yes. Yeah, so some states allow it at the high school level. And so think about, you know, you and your kids, and so, like, think about a freshman, sophomore trying to navigate being a teenager and doing okay in school and doing well on the field, and this new pressure to all of a sudden they're supposed to be like a social media star, you know, that is bringing in deals. And I get that maybe I'm speaking from a place of kind of privilege, in a sense of like, I recognize this could be transformative for some families, right? For their kid to be able to pursue an NIL deal in high school, that could change the trajectory of an entire family. But we're layering it on top of what is already a system that is producing major mental health and physical health issues. And it's a burning fire of doing things in a way that doesn't actually produce the best outcomes in a human way. Now we're just throwing money onto that fire, you know,
so
that, that is the American way, of course, but it is also, it's also something that I see from my vantage point and perspective as something we really need to be mindful of and be managing. And, you know, and again, I'm fortunate to be able to work with, at the University of Texas, student athletes who won, right? Who won this lottery and have through hard work and good luck and good genetics and all that stuff, have been able to get a college scholarship at one of the premier institutions in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of them struggle, you know, like we think of that as like, they're the success stories. And some of them are, you know, really working through, a lot of them are really working through the same thing any of us would, right? I think we tend to treat athletes as these like superheroes and superhumans, but they're us. And so I get to see it from a face-to-face standpoint of how much stress this all was before NIL. Now you have new obligations. You know, you're the wide receiver for the football team, and now you have to make sure that you also post X number of times on your social media about this brand, and that you attend multiple events sponsored by the brand. You know, like, that's in addition to the other things that you have to do, and you already had no wiggle room in your schedule. So as I confessed before, I like this in a broad sense. I like that student athletes are having more freedom to be able to pursue it, but everything comes with a cost. And I think we've not been really good at managing the sort of negative externalities or the negative impacts that come from the systems that we use to develop athletes.
Right. Well, and I guess that kind of brings me back to something I brought up kind of a little bit earlier, like who's helping them who's helping the athletes navigate these deals? Because you might end up going, hey, that looks like a really great deal, but in turn, you're getting very minimal money or just free product, but you're having to do all of these things for the brand that you don't realize you have locked yourself into. Like, are athletes, are the universities, or do they have to do it on their own? Like with agents, like, I guess who's looking out for them in that respect as they navigate this new ordeal? Or are they just kind of having to figure it out?
It's like I said, before, the Wild West, right? So it's all over the map, that there are some universities that have a more well-developed infrastructure mm-hmm. to support this. And they have people in the athletic department who are working with them on their branding and, you know, like thinking about these deals and understanding the contractual elements of the deals. And then you also have people who are out there on their own. And, you know, there was an example of a football player for the Florida Gators who committed to an NIL contract that basically like signed away his rights in perpetuity to kind of control his own image. And that's an extreme example, but one that you see when you have this sort of this crazy, it's like that old like supermarket sweep, but I'm really dating myself, you know, where you're running through the aisles and you got to grab all the stuff. Like there's a feeling of that for a lot of people. And when you're operating at that level of kind of chaos and uncertainty, you're going to see situations that are not good. So I don't think we are, in my kind of personal take on this, I don't think we are absolutely like off the rails, out of control. I think there's some of that happening at the edges, but I think largely it's just something that would benefit from more structure, you know, more management, you know, and this is in large part can be attributed to the failure of the NCAA to do what you might consider its fundamental job. And so I won't get into an NCAA bashing session because I love college sports in many respects. And the NCAA has done lots of good things, but they had every opportunity over the last decade plus and beyond to really get out in front of this and instead they dug their heels in and anchored around this, you know, the mythology that these are amateur athletes and that somehow makes it more pure. And that comes with its own cost, right? So now the NCAA football is leaving it behind slowly and maybe more rapidly, but I don't think it's going away. But I do think it really failed to in its duty, you know, to be able to be the leading voice for athletes, student athletes in this space in a way that was reasonable and set this up for success. And so that's, you know, and we won't get into, because if you want to really get confused, we could go there, but we won't get into the sort of legal challenges to the NCAA and the employment classification of student athletes. There are a number of lawsuits in process right now that I could see fundamentally altering the relationship between student athletes and universities here in the not too distant future. So that maybe that's another podcast, but it speaks to, you know, this broader issue that I'm very disappointed in the NCAA. You know, I think it had an opportunity to really try to work with stakeholders to create a structure that would make this transition smooth and better for everyone involved. And they instead kind of put their head in the sand and tried not to do it.
Kind of like every big sports organization, when they're put to it, they don't want to make a bad call, so they don't make any calls. And so then things just happen around them, you know, and that's USO or not USO, the IOC does that a lot, you know, with the Olympic Games and things like that. We see that kind of mess all the time. They don't want to make decisions, so they throw it on an international governing body or a, you know, it's always a mess. But kind of going back a little bit to what we were talking about, just kind of knowing your value. We did have an agent on back on episode 81. His name is CG Young, and he talked a little bit about like how athletes can build their brands, especially when they don't have an agent or something helping them. But he also in the episodes talks a little bit about like what you're worth. Like, don't be just getting free product and giving all your time, energy and effort to that. He kind of talks a little bit about your value and what basic things are generally worth. So that's always, if you're an athlete kind of trying to navigate some of this stuff, that's a great place to start as well. Just kind of getting some numbers on things just to wrap your head around maybe what you could start at if you don't know. But I'd love to pivot and kind of see, with all of this happening right now, how does NIL influence or affect the scholarships being given out? Like, are universities kind of changing how they're recruiting people based on like, hey, maybe I don't need to recruit this person because they'll have enough NIL deals, but I'm going to spend my money here with scholarships elsewhere? Are scholarships going to go away in the future? I've heard rumors of that because people are getting so many, the schools are getting so many NIL deals. Like, I don't know. These are all just rumors and hearsay. So I'm just asking you the question since you are like feet on the ground, you know, at the university and in the middle of this.
Yeah, it's a really good question that I don't think anybody has a really good answer for, honestly, at this point. To my knowledge, at least at the sort of Power 5 or Power 4 level, we are not presently seeing it play out that way, where it's like, oh, well, we can reallocate scholarships here. And we, you know, the NIL allows us to do that, in large part because we're still beholden to the requirements of Title IX, right? So we still have to have opportunities that are scaled in concert with the broader university population and be making efforts to pursue getting opportunities to the underrepresented, you know, group. And so to my knowledge, we are not seeing that yet, or at least nobody's talking about that yet. You know, it's also, I often have to check myself a little bit on the fact that like Texas is not everywhere, right? Like right. It's, we had the executive senior associate athletic director, Sarah Baumgartner, come to my class yesterday and talk to the students, and she's wonderful. And she's been at a number of, you know, Big Ten schools, which are also Power Five and all, and coming from, she was at Rutgers before she came to Texas. And she sort of put it in perspective of like, I was at Rutgers for, I think it was 10 years, and I got one national championship ring from a single wrestler.
Yeah.
And then I've been at Texas a little under 3 years, and I have 6 national championship rings.
Wow.
You know, so it's really easy from my perspective to kind of forget that when we talk about these things, like Texas is the unusual one, not the norm. And
right.
So when we think about scholarships, when we think about that setup, I think we have to recognize that like not every school, not every sport is just raking in NIL dollars hand over fist. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think we're probably already on our way to a little bit of a contraction. These brands are all doing a land grab right now of like, well, I want to be with this, you know, I want to get in on with this person or this program. But they're going to start to see that not all NIL deals are created equal, right? And you're not necessarily going to get this massive return on everything that you do. Now, having said that, when we look at the data around engagement with social media posts related to NIL, when we look at a lot of the metrics, student athletes are way overperforming relative to general types of promotional efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and as I mentioned before, in particular, female athletes, women's sports is way over indexing in those areas. So that's been one of the most exciting things for brands who are rapidly moving into the women's sports space is that, you know, maybe it's smaller in terms of raw numbers, which, you know, is just a structural thing at this stage, but the level of engagement, the amount of purchasing, you know, the sort of repeat visits and spending and stuff with fans of women's sports, brands are like, holy cow, like this is incredible. Like we haven't really had a vehicle like this to connect with this target demographic. So there's just so much that's still in flux right now as we look at this situation, and it'll continue to evolve. It'll change and evolve. My guess is it'll cool off a bit over the coming years, or at least settle, you know, into patterns that are maybe a little bit more predictable.
Sure.
Unless we see some big shock to the system again.
Like a lawsuit or something.
yeah. Like that there could be some major ramifications from a lawsuit or from some other policy change. So if we keep on keeping on with the way that we are, I think the market in a broad sense will sort of settle into a little bit more of a predictable pattern. But but yeah, we're still in that moment.
Do you think this gives like D3 and D2 schools more opportunities to bring in like good athletes if they can have NIL deals or collectives to help out with that stuff? Like, do you think that can give some universities a better advantage in some ways or not really? Is it just kind of give athletes more opportunity in general?
I think that's something that sounds more likely in theory than is actually going to happen.
Why is that?
Well, let's extend it even to something, not even looking at D2, D3. Let's look at schools that are, let's look at like Power Five schools that are in smaller markets.
Okay.
Right. So you now have the Pac-2 for the moment, with Oregon State and Washington State.
Right.
And there's some fascinating things going on there with like who gets to be like the conservator of the Pac-12 brand and the assets and all that. That's again another podcast. But when you look at Pullman, Washington, right, or Corvallis, or you look at some of these smaller university towns, like can they keep student athletes who are, you know, potentially massive assets from an NIL and collective standpoint. And that's going to be a challenge. Are we going to see schools that are in bigger media markets that maybe haven't been bigger schools, like a University of Houston, for example?
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to emerge in a different way simply because they're located in one of the largest media markets in the U.S. Right. And so a student athlete who's highly marketable could say, well, I'll come play at Houston and you know, have all these incredible deals because I can reach and access this market. Because one of the things we've seen while we talk about kind of big national level NIL deals a lot, what we've seen is where this has been most utilized is with, you know, it's kind of hyper localized, right? Yeah. So where you have a local restaurant who is working with, you know, a handful of track and field athletes, right? And like they're sponsoring them on a really small scale to promote the restaurant. We're seeing a lot more of that. I know that's not like the sexy, like let's talk big numbers and stuff, but when we look at
I think that's great deals. For a local economy too. Like that's awesome. Right. Yeah.
Right. Well, and if you're a local business, mm-hmm. being able to, at a relatively cheap rate, I would imagine, you know, being able to connect with your local market in a way that is very salient or meaningful to them by utilizing student athletes in the process, like, yeah, that has the potential to be something
yeah.
beneficial for both parties.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to share a quick story, and a coach was telling me this, and I can't even remember what sport the athlete was in, but they got some NIL deal with a local restaurant, like you're mentioning. And I guess he had to eat so many meals or visit the restaurant so many times, I don't know, in a week or a month or something. Well, he just started taking all of his teammates that couldn't afford food or weren't, you know, in the same place that he was. So he just started bringing people in to get free meals. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's just awesome. So these are the great stories of like the yeah. NILs. I love that. I'm a sucker for that stuff. I thought that was so cool.
That is cool.
Yeah.
I am too. I think as I've probably revealed through the way that I talk about these things, you know, I'm somebody that thinks that sports are this incredibly powerful context, right? Like I don't think they're inherently good or inherently bad, but I do think they're one of the most powerful contexts for human development. And so NIL is now sort of a new opportunity, a new outlet, a new kind of subcontext within sports through which we can pursue good, mm-hmm. right? Through which we can raise money, raise awareness, you know, do good for our communities. And there are a lot of student athletes who are utilizing their NIL platforms to help. And I think that's something that is really exciting about this, right? So the lack of regulation, the lack of structure enables a wide range of potential experiences and outcomes, that some of which are actually really, really incredible and moving and powerful and beneficial to the community, right? And then some of which are just kind of how we talk about big business and all that stuff. So mm-hmm. yeah, I love that story. And you can dig around, you know, on the internet and find tons of examples of student athletes who are doing similar types of,
yeah.
of whether it's really small like that or working with an organization, you know, on an even bigger scale.
I love it. I love it. Well, so what do you see now? Like when we talk about youth athletes and we're developing them into like college and then maybe potentially pro, but like, what is the difference now between college and pro? Like, is there even, besides going to school at the same time that you're being a pro athlete, what is the difference between college and pro with NIL in the game?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's less difference than there ever has been. You know, I think that's the reality of it. And big time college athletics has long been sort of professional version of sports, mm-hmm. right? In some ways. And so I think this is just the natural extension of that. You know, we're seeing some really interesting impacts of NIL relative to the professional game. So let me give you a couple of examples. So if you are, you heard me mention some of the top women's basketball players in the country.
Mm-hmm.
If you are Angel Reese or Caitlin Clark, you can make more through NIL than your WNBA salary would pay you.
Whoa.
And so you end up staying longer in college. And
interesting.
So I think people will naturally assume that this is the destruction of college athletics, but in some ways, I'll give you another example, staying with basketball. That's kind of my jam. So when you look at the preseason, you know, watch list for like, you know, the best players in men's college basketball, you notice an almost overrepresentation of these kind of like more old school, like big 7-footers who are a little more lumbering and clunky. Mm-hmm. They're not really who we prioritize in the modern NBA, but those guys are now, instead of being one and done and trying to make it in the NBA and getting drafted in the second round or whatever, they are now also staying around more because they can get paid a pretty good amount of money to continue to play college basketball.
So why not go ahead and get my degree, right? And I can still do that later, but I'm already getting paid. Because I think that's why people tend to leave, is because like, well, I can start making money. So I'm going to leave and I'll finish school later or not.
Yeah. So that, I think that's one of these really fascinating unintended consequences of this, is we're seeing people, we're seeing student athletes like recalculate their own timetables in terms of, you know, how long they're going to stay in college, and in a way almost lessen that pressure that they have to, as soon as they possibly can, go and start making money.
That's a huge perk. And I would love, since you sound like you're the stats guy, I'm gonna challenge you, because I'll have you back on the show. We got like three or four more episodes we're gonna be talking about, I think. But I would love for you to keep stats on, like, does it change? Like, does the graduation rate change? Do athletes have a longer longevity? That's totally not a thing. Do they have more longevity?
sure.
Within college, are they getting their degrees more? Like, is that, you know, are the rates going up? Like, that would be really interesting to track. I mean, I know it's, like you said, we're only a couple of years into this, but that would be something really interesting to keep track.
Yeah, no, I'm similarly interested by that. And I think, as you mentioned, we're only 2.5 years into this, and we're still also, what would throw off the rates would be the COVID years and all that additional stuff. But like, but yes, as we mentioned, as things like kind of the dust settles and we have a little more rhythm around this, my guess is we would see more athletes staying longer, maybe not at the same school.
Right.
That's another aspect of this, you know, that isn't, that we have to actually talk about. So let's talk about it.
Okay,
so
bring it.
Because you can't talk about it in a vacuum, right? Yeah. So NIL doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists in as a part of an ecosystem where the loosened regulations that I also support around allowing more fluidity with what we would call the transfer portal in some of the major sports, these things are working in concert together. So the transfer portal, for those who don't know, is what it sounds like, where, you know, okay, you're at Texas, but you're buried on the bench, you know, or you know, whatever sport you're playing, and you're not getting playing time. It used to be that you kind of had to tough it out, or you had to get the blessing and official permission to seek a transfer, and then you had to sit out a year, and that, you know, all these very onerous regulations that I should say didn't seem to apply to coaches who could move freely whenever they
wanted. That's a really good stinking point right there.
Yeah. So I'm all for more flexibility for somebody to say, like, hey, you know what? It's not really working here in Austin. Or even, you know, in a more specific example, like, hey, I need to be home. My mom is sick. You know, I need to be able to move back home or whatever. So during COVID, the NCAA really loosened up the requirements. So now you could transfer and be immediately eligible. And they've put a little bit more structure to it in, you know, over this past year, but haven't really fundamentally changed the ability of a student athlete to put themselves into the transfer portal and be able to essentially function as a free agent. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's what this is. There's a free agency element to college sports now, which I know makes some people shudder. Right. I know it's sort of, some listeners may hear that and it's like, this is another thing that's eroding the magic of college sports and it's just blending into pro sports or whatever. And I hear that. That's not unfair to say. But what's really interesting is, because of the transfer portal and NIL, you basically have, and there's been a shocking level of transparency about this. You know, you basically have the ability to go buy players, you know, through your collectives and, you know, like, and there's even kind of market rates that are not published or anything, of like, well, to get a top tier quarterback, you know, it's going to need to be between 2 and 3 million or something thereabouts a year. You know, I know that sounds insane. Yeah. So it's something that is a new part of this landscape, and NIL very much intersects with the transfer portal, right?
Wow.
So as we're recording this, the college football season is wrapping up. College basketball seasons are kicking off. And so there are players who, you know, who aren't happy or aren't getting the playing time they hoped for or whatever, and are putting themselves in the transfer portal and are being sought after by other schools. And one of the interesting things is what we're seeing with this is we're seeing a lot of like mid-major schools become the primary recruiting focus of Power Five schools, right? So like,
interesting.
Is Texas still trying to recruit five-star high school player? Of course, right? But in addition to that, they're really recruiting from these kind of mid-major, mid-tier schools and trying to pluck somebody who maybe is a wide receiver who overperformed at University of Toledo, for example, and say, well, hey, you come over here and, you know, through our collective and the things that we can do, like we can make that attractive for you. And I know this all kind of feels a little sleazy, but it's what's happening right now. And it's the reason why, well, it's created this really fascinating effect where as a really powerful school, a Texas, a Notre Dame, you know, a UCLA, whatever, and you have this ability to sort of reboot your team pretty quickly. We saw an extreme example of that at the University of Colorado with Deion Sanders, and they had something like 40 new players, 40, 50 new players come in. And I'm not saying that's the way, right? But they'd been 1-12 or, you know, they'd been terrible for years. And so it was a house cleaning and through the transfer portal, you can bring in a bunch of other folks. And so I try to look at things with a sort of, for as passionate as I am about sports, I try to be academic and like dispassionate about how I understand these pieces. And so I can have my personal take on some of this stuff, but it's nothing if not fascinating.
Right.
Right. As a new feature of whatever this system we call college athletics is.
It is certainly interesting for sure. Well, what advice would you have, like, as we kind of wrap it up here, like, what advice do you have for young athletes coming up? And again, because we were talking about not only do you have NIL and everything, kids are being recruited much earlier because that's legal now, which is just wild to me. Like, they're starting to talk to college coaches early in high school, and that's just such a trip. So what advice do you have for these young athletes coming up to maybe not be overwhelmed, but at the same time to be able to take advantage of these amazing opportunities they currently have?
Yeah. So, and again, this might vary a little bit depending on whether you're in a state that permits high school level NIL or you're, you know, we'll talk about it from the...
How many states do that? How many high
schools? That's a really good question. I actually don't know off the top of my head.
Got to be small.
It's, yeah, I won't venture a guess because I'll sound way off, but they do exist, right? So, but we'll set those aside for now and talk more about like kind of preparing for college. And I think the first thing I would say, this may sound strange, the first thing I would say is you don't have to do anything, right? Like, I think that's important to acknowledge as a starting point because we're in the world that we exist in that is so high pressure, especially for young athletes who are elite tracking. You know, you have so much on your plate to begin with. And so many difficult decisions ahead of you, you know, in terms of finding the best fit for you in your, you know, in your journey. And so I think it's important for parents and athletes to start from the place of like, this is extra. This is not something that we absolutely must do. And again, maybe your specific family, it's a real need to be able to maximize this. And I respect that. But for most of us, it's extra. And so as you make your decisions around thinking about what school you may want to be at, where, what the right fit is for you, make those decisions in a way where you don't feel like your happiness, your overall well-being is tied to a specific NIL opportunity, right? So like looking for fit with the coaching staff, looking for fit at the, you know, with the university itself and the types of program or classes you can take and all that, because you're a whole person, right? You're not just an athlete. And, you know, you want to make sure that you're in a place in terms of your mental and physical well-being where you can be excited about taking advantage of these things rather than feeling like you're already overworked, you're already not liking your coach, you're already all of these things, and you're supposed to go be a social media like mogul, right? So starting from the place of like, this is extra, you don't have to do it. As you explore schools, if this is something that is really appealing to you, you know, really making sure that you have those conversations about what type of infrastructure is in place to potentially support your efforts to do this, right? Yeah. And I would say starting small from a sort of values-driven position, right? Are there things that are important to you? Are there things that are interesting to you, either as an athlete or more broadly? And pursue things that you feel like aligns with who you want to be as a person, right? And I think it's really easy to get pulled away from that and to start chasing things where you're like, well, I don't really love this product, or I don't, you know, really believe in selling this particular thing, but I mean, it's like 10 grand, you know, like I could use that. And I don't fault anybody for, you know, trying to help support themselves and their families. But I think long-term happiness and fulfillment and well-being comes from really having a clear sense of who you are and then how you pursue that
right
in and through the NIL, potential NIL deals that you would look to.
Well, right. It's kind of like getting a job, right? I mean, you could get a job to have a job, but if you hate what you're doing, like, you're going to be miserable. It's going to roll into your life outside of work, like, you know, all those things. So you want to make sure you're trying your best, at least to be supported by things that you also support or are passionate about. Yeah. Because then you're just quality of life, your mental health, all those things are going to be better because you're surrounding yourself by things that you're, you know, happy about or good with, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's those things are very fragile, right? And especially as an athlete, like maybe things aren't going as well as you'd hope in the pool, right? Or on the track. And maybe you arrive at a place like Texas feeling like you won and realizing like, I'm the worst player on this team, right? Or I'm never going to see any action. I'm not connecting with the coaching staff or my teammates. Like, that could happen, right? So these things are really fragile in addition to all that, the stress and the things we have to manage, you know, when we're layering on top of that things that are not in alignment with kind of what brings us fulfillment and satisfaction, then that can only worsen, you know, something that's already a difficult situation. So, and I don't mean to sound really negative. I'm not. I hope I've made clear, like, I love sports.
Yeah.
I think sports can be incredible, but I think we're lying to ourselves if we act like, you know, sports are intrinsically this thing that's just going to produce good.
Right.
So yeah, as a young athlete, as you navigate this, do things that are fun and that support kind of how you see yourself and how you want other people to see you in the world. And I think that's as good a starting point as you can have.
I totally agree. I think that's awesome. Well, Matt, thank you so much for coming on and helping clarify so much of this confusion. I love how you
did. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I love your description of the Wild West and the chaos. Like, just makes me feel better about, okay, if I understand a little bit, I'm ahead of the game. You know?
Yeah, because again, nobody understands it fully at this stage.
Right, but it is an opportunity in a lot of ways for the athletes coming up. And so, you know, while things are still being navigated, like, athletes, do your best to, you know, navigate the situation to your advantage as well. Like, have high integrity with how you do it, but this is such an incredible opportunity that people like me did not have, and I've had mixed feelings. I just didn't understand it, but wow, take advantage of the opportunity. It's there for you. Partner with things like Matt said that you're passionate about, that you really, you know, like, want to be partnered with, and support yourself in the process of doing the sport that you love. Like, that is an awesome opportunity. So Matt, thanks for describing the Wild West to us. We'll have our guns out and we will have you back on, I'm sure, to explain a lot more deep topics like this.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. And please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. This allows us to keep bringing on amazing guests, and it also helps other athletes to find this show. Make sure to check out the show notes to follow us on social media and learn more about our awesome guest. To hear all of our amazing episodes, head on over to thepursuitofgold.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Pursuit of Gold is proud to be a Podigy production. That's all for now. Make sure to tune back in next week.